want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I feel safe in telling you you're about to hear an analysis of the Iranian nuclear talks that you won't hear almost anywhere else, certainly not in the corporate media in this country. Independent journalist Gareth Porter returns to our program today. He's the author of Manufactured Crisis. He was in Vienna covering the final stage of the talks between Six Nations and Iran. And we're going to talk about his stunning analysis that's free of the American exceptionalism bullshit about how clever the Iranians were in using their nuclear program to end the estrangement, to end many of the sanctions that have been imposed on it since the 1979 revolution. And I'd like to hear your comments after you've heard Gareth Porter's analysis. Every day I like to thank people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Carl Howard, who just took out a new monthly subscription, Jeff Zeiser, and of course, I want to thank Gunnar Gunderson, who has not one, but two monthly subscriptions. I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, you click the link that says sign up. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers anywhere in the world get a bonus gift from me. It's the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Gareth Porter returns to our podcast today, fresh back from Vienna, where he observed the talks that led to a nuclear deal with Iran. The P5 Plus One, negotiated for 20 months with the Iranians. And I want to begin by saying that this is not a bilateral deal between the United States and Iran. But that's how it's treated on these shores, with Israel being the prime mover and the agenda setter for so many of our elected leaders in this country. Gareth Porter, for many years now, has provided a kind of alternative narrative about the intentions of Iran based on U.S. intelligence reports. And he's the independent journalist who has filed some very important dispatches from Vienna and now stateside since he has returned. Gareth, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Peter. Glad to be back.
Your book entitled Manufactured Crisis, I think, is highly informative, and I still regard it as a very important look at these issues. Do you think that we have somehow disassembled the crisis process, or at least delayed it, with the outcome of these negotiations?
Yeah, there's no question this agreement reaches the end of an era, which is the era of sort of scaremongering about the Iranian nuclear program. I think we can look forward to at least a gradual subsiding of the hype about that issue. And I think what we're seeing, of course, is at the same time, you know, it crosses over a separate trend line, which is the rising hype about an alleged Iranian hegemonic moves in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and that's going to become increasingly the primary crisis that we are urged to focus on.
And
I put crisis in quote marks.
Yes, and this is going to be a political firestorm for the next 60 to 75 days as we hear shrill, inaccurate, trumped-up talking points thrown at this deal, many of which are completely irrelevant because, a lot of the criticisms are that it doesn't do this or that, it doesn't stop Iran from funding Hezbollah, and it was never intended to do that. And so a lot of people in this kind of post-game scrum are working to really fog the air with a lot of irrelevant points. Of course, all of this, as you have so artfully reported to us, is based on a series of lies and exaggerations. And I want to start here with a couple of quotes from Professor William Beeman, who wrote a piece noting that Iran's nuclear program was not secret. It was started by the United States 40 years ago. We gave them their first research reactor. That Iran has never had a nuclear weapon, and there's no evidence that they were actually hell-bent to develop one, which is, of course, the main meme in the West. And that enrichment of uranium somehow amounts to the possession of a nuclear weapon. And Iran only reached 20% enrichment, which is not enough to develop a weapon. Yet the hysterical red line that Netanyahu drew in that cartoon that he presented at the United Nations a couple of years ago still stands in the minds of many people as something real.
Yeah, I mean, you've done a fine job of sort of summarizing a number of the key themes in the false narrative that has been propounded over the last decade in particular. But, it began even before the so-called crisis that I have documented in my book. There are so many things that, we don't have time to even begin to cover them that have been falsified in this narrative. I was just thinking this morning about how many of the alleged pieces of evidence that the Iranians had been working, had started to work on a nuclear weapon in the mid-1980s during the Iran-Iraq War, which I, dutifully tracked down every one of them and found that in every case they were falsifications, they were clearly bogus documents or bogus stories, which have been given status by the news media and by certain think tanks like David Albright's ISIS in Washington, D.C. This is a big part of the process by which this false narrative was created. And of course, the think tanks, the news media, simply dutifully go along with this without the slightest critical review or fact-checking.
Now, with this in mind, and Beeman summed it up extremely well in one sentence, Iran was able to win, that's his view, because it was very easy for it to bluff by giving up activities in which it had never engaged and never intended to engage. And this is the important backstory to your powerful analysis piece that you published at Middle East Eye a couple of days ago, entitled How a Weaker Iran Got the Hegemon, the United States and its allies, to lift sanctions. And you explain how through essentially a very careful nuclear bluff that was played out over more than 10 years, that Iran was able to change the dynamic that was set in place and kind of locked in place since the revolution back in 1979.
Yeah, this is a very important story, Peter, and I'm glad that you've brought it up because, in my view, it's one of the most important things that I've written about the entire Iran nuclear issue. Looking, from the point of view of the immense disparity of power between the United States and Iran, which colors everything that has happened between the two countries ever since the Iranian Revolution. I think this is a big problem for the world's most powerful nation and its political system, that there is no capability to understand how disparities in power have shaped our policies toward the rest of the world, and particularly, of course, middle-sized powers like, or middle-sized states like Iran, and also, you know, they have shaped the policies of the other states who are subject to U.S. power. And this story about what happened between the United States and Iran over the 1990s and the period since the turn of the century illustrates this perfectly, because what we've seen is that the Iranian dominant political faction, which was led by former President Rafsanjani, really wanted to integrate Iran into the global economic system. And the United States, particularly beginning with the Clinton administration, denied that possibility by imposing a total trade embargo on Iran in 1995. And the Iranians wanted to have a political diplomatic dialogue with the United States, but they could not do so as long as the United States, in this case the Clinton administration, absolutely refused to talk about lifting the embargo. And so it was an unequal situation regarding the political diplomatic relationship. And what the supreme leader of Iran recognized early in this process, and I give him a lot of credit for this as a strategist, is that Iran would have to come up with some way of getting the United States' attention to get it to enter into an actual, honest, political, diplomatic dialogue or a set of negotiations, a give and take between sovereign nations, which it had, the United States had refused to do. And what the Supreme Leader recognized was that the nuclear program was really the only possible candidate for being able to accomplish that. Now, that does not mean, by the way, that it was what you call a nuclear bluff. In other words, the Iranians were not suggesting to the United States, either openly or slyly, that they were interested in nuclear weapons and that the United States better come to attention or you know, the Iranians would get nuclear weapons. On the contrary, all they were doing was to say to the Americans, in effect, that you know we're going to have a nuclear program, and the only way we can get your attention is to continue to enrich uranium. And so from 2006 on, the Iranians did, in fact, begin to enrich uranium. And the key thing was the accumulation of a stockpile of low-enriched uranium from 2006 to 2010. And then in 2010, beginning the process, as you mentioned earlier, of 20% enrichment. And that really did get the attention of the Obama administration, finally. And the combination of those two things really compelled the Obama administration to abandon a policy that it had adopted in the first 4 years, which was to not enter into a diplomatic dialogue with Iran on an equal basis, but to put pressure on Iran through economic sanctions, through a cyber attack, and through the exploitation of the threat of an Israeli attack on Iran. So this represents a huge shift for the Obama administration to actually enter into ordinary give-and-take negotiations with Iran. It was a big moment in the history of this relationship, and that's what made possible this this final agreement 3 years later.
And Gareth, I just want to commend you because you set a standard for journalists that is largely unmet these days, but you have offered a critical analysis without the jingoism and the American exceptionalism coloring your judgment. And I have to agree that the Ayatollah has been extremely shrewd and that the Iranians have, you know, overcome some of the setbacks of the Ahmadinejad era and I think solidified in this new reality in the, you know, Middle East that now includes the so-called Islamic State. where it has carved out a very interesting position for itself. And by honoring the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it is signed to, and which I'll note that Israel is not, you know, Iran has managed to, and I'll accept your correction of my term bluff, but this has been a very carefully orchestrated sequence of events that avoided the pitfalls that have left two others who attempted something roughly similar, and I'm thinking of Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, who didn't survive their efforts to kind of use ambiguities veiled threats to try to preserve the control that those two dictators once had. And so I think it's very important for Americans to get beyond the spin and all of the bullshit criticisms that are coming from the right, and understand that this was a remarkable effort and that Iran really deserves credit, probably not praise from Americans, but honest credit for what they achieved here.
Very good point, Peter. And I would just add that... you know, the American people have, I'm afraid to say, have never been good at recognizing or coming to terms with their own responsibility, the responsibility of the United States for the impacts, the effects of actions and policies that the United States has taken.
Mm-hmm.
And this is no more true than in the case of Iran. I mean, the biggest problem that we've had in terms of sorting out what is actually going on and why is that the United States government and the news media and the political elite simply refuse to take any responsibility for the impact of what the United States has done over the years. And I just very quickly want to mention that you know, you cannot understand the evolution of the U.S. and the Iranian policies over the last decade without taking into account the reality that the Bush administration and Israel were both threatening to attack Iran over and over again through, not through a formal declaration, but through hints and through implication and through various kinds of rhetoric, not the least of which was, of course, the Axis of Evil speech. And, you know, to expect that Iran would not respond in a variety of ways to defend itself, to protect its national interest, its vital interest, in light of those threats, is the supreme lack of realism and lack of responsibility, in my view.
Well, and let me just add to your description there that during this same time period, we and the Israelis have been running covert operations that have killed Iranian scientists in broad daylight, in rush hour traffic. We use the Stuxnet virus, which, many people think, oh, how cool. Isn't that cool, man?
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's an act of war.
Very aggressive actions by the United States seem to fall away whenever the rhetoric begins.
Right.
And that's really a fundamental problem that we've got to address in this country, in our politics.
And it is remarkable that the Iranians have shown, at least on an overt level, remarkable restraint, because they didn't respond to Stuxnet as an act of war and with retaliatory measures that one could rationalize from their point of view.
That's absolutely right. And Peter, let me tell you something. I mean, I just want to make something clear. When I started covering the Iran nuclear issue in 2006, I was prepared to believe the official line, the general political line of the United States, that, of course, Iran wanted to get nuclear weapons. They are keen on getting nuclear weapons. The only question is whether it's realistic for them, whether they can get away with it. It depends on the circumstances. And it was only by dint of really a long period of looking into the specifics of the history of the situation in great detail that I was able to understand just how utterly wrong I was. Because the reality is that Iran is an extremely unusual case. It's an extraordinary case in world politics. Iran is the one state in the history of the world, to my knowledge, which has taken a stand not only against nuclear weapons, but against all weapons of mass destruction based on spiritual, religious, ethical grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fundamental fact that cannot be denied if you look into the history of the Iran-Iraq war, and you know that Iran had the opportunity to respond, and the motivation to respond to Iraqi use of chemical weapons over and over again during that eight-year war.
Some supplied by the United States.
Well, certainly supplying the equipment, yes,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. The United States and its allies.
And the intelligence. We also gave...
And helping them with intelligence,
yeah.
helping them with targeting, absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So the Iranians had the means, they had the ability to you know, formulate the chemical weapons, and they had very strong motivation. In fact, I can tell you for a fact that the IRGC was urging the Supreme Leader to use chemical weapons. And nevertheless, Ayatollah Khomeini said, absolutely not, this is illegal in Islam, and we cannot even possess them, let alone use them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a fundamental fact that cannot be denied, and yet it is excluded completely from the discussion of the Iranian nuclear issue, except for my book. I can't find any other literature where this is discussed.
Mm-hmm. And let me lift a power quote here from near the end of your analysis, Gareth. So the main backstory of the nuclear agreement is that it was Iranian counterpressure on the United States through its nuclear program that finally compelled the Obama administration to change its strategy of relying mainly on coercion and begin the negotiations that Iran had wanted for more than two decades. And this, again, is an analysis we're not going to hear or see anywhere in corporate media outlets here in the United States.
I'm sorry to say you're absolutely right about that. I mean, the news media is swept clean of any thinking that is anywhere close to this kind of dissent. And this is it seems to be an iron law that's the way the system works.
Well, and I heard a promo on the PBS NewsHour last night that I should stay tuned because Charlie Rose was going to have a lively debate between a neocon and an arch-conservative neocon.
Yes, I saw the same thing, and I had to, I don't know if I laughed or cried, I can't remember which, but
I
did have a reaction.
While we're talking about PBS, I've got to call this one out, because I do watch the NewsHour as a reference point of the Beltway dynamic and consensus at any given moment, and I was floored and offended when Gwen Ifill brought out Susan Rice for a one-on-one interview about the newly announced negotiated deal. And there was no foreplay, okay? There was nothing like, the president must be pretty happy and John Kerry, you know, must be relieved. And it was just the very first question was, Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't approve of this deal.
Right. I saw that. I heard that as well. And that is an extraordinary example, not extraordinary, an ordinary example of what is wrong with the U.S. news media coverage of this.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely the primary theme of this coverage has been for years what the Israelis think of the negotiations. I mean, this is for reasons which I think deserve much closer scrutiny than it's gotten, the leitmotif of news media coverage of this issue.
Well, and it also helps define or frame the opposition that is using talking points that come from Israel, that come from AIPAC. And these are senators and members of Congress who really don't know much about the deal. They just recite what the experts feed to them. But as I mentioned at the outset, we're going to see a lot of distractions thrown at this of saying, well, but it doesn't rein in their ability to use missiles.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, well, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. You raised some of the most interesting points that I've been thinking about, and that's one of them. I mean, one of the premises of U.S. Politics and policy toward Iran is that we have every right to tell the Iranians that they have no right to the most elementary defense means of defending themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else in the world has the right, but not Iran. They cannot have missiles. They cannot have the means to retaliate against an attack on Iran, despite the fact that on the public record, there have been many, many threats to attack through air power mm-hmm. against Iran. So it's an extraordinary situation, and this, again, seems to pass notice completely in the discourse on the issue.
Well, and Netanyahu made this statement, you know, this is not binding on Israel. Israel was not a party to these negotiations.
Right. Therefore, it has the right to threaten to do whatever it wants. Yeah.
Well, right, and he continues to make those threats, and it complicates the picture, muddies the waters, and I give The Guardian credit for its report on July 15th from Tel Aviv, actually Jerusalem, sorry, where they cited a number of the critics of Netanyahu, including some of his reliably conservative supporters, who think that he is going way too far in trying to blow up this deal and that it's going to harm the interests of Israel going forward. I'm pleased to finally see some pushback there against
right.
Netanyahu
and
in his own country.
It's not incidental, I think, that this is in a foreign newspaper rather than in the U.S. News media. I think it highlights a critical difference here, that mm-hmm. there are different viewpoints or different perspectives that are represented in the coverage outside the United States. But in this country, the news media have, in fact, hewed very closely to the Israeli line. It's just extraordinary that the news media in this case is not really supporting the policy of the incumbent administration, but rather is well to the right of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, it seems to me that the people who are critical of this system and of the policy really need to come to grips with why this is happening and come up with an analysis about this and what needs to be done about it.
Gareth Porter with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Gareth, on July 12th, you published a piece that you wrote in Vienna at MiddleEastEye.com, and I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast. But you exposed the story that we weren't getting from the mainstream media in this country about why, based on your account, the Obama team was instructed to go slow during the final week as the deadlines kept slipping and being extended. And you describe how the U.S., instead of talking directly with the Iranians, was doing more coordination with the people on its side of the table. And then the goalposts were moved, as I like to say, and the a new issue was raised about the arms embargo that was imposed on Iran, I think, in 2006 or 2007. And in your piece, you educated me. I was not aware that Iran has a fairly thriving munitions industry and doesn't really require imports to sustain its military programs.
Yes, the key thing here about Iran's military is that they have, in fact, been forced for many years to be self-reliant, just as they have had to be self-reliant economically. It's even more true of their military procurements and their military establishment. So they have gotten used to not being reliant on external sources. That doesn't mean that they are not interested in any new technology. Of course, we are all familiar with the S-300 controversy, the Russian air defense system mm-hmm. that the Russians promised them and then pulled back and now apparently are going to go ahead with it. But in terms of ordinary conventional weapons, the Iranians are extremely self-reliant. And, the problem with this policy from their point of view was not that they expected to be harmed by a continuation of an arms embargo, but rather it was the symbolism of this. They mm-hmm. wanted symbolically and politically for all the sanctions to be lifted. That was the important thing for the Iranians. And the Americans now seem to be welching on that idea by trying to maintain this embargo. Mm-hmm. So that was the problem.
And Gareth, what I didn't quite fully grok was why the Obama team was told to slow this down so it didn't meet the July 9th deadline. And that's critical because of this silly bill that Congress passed to review this agreement. Gave it 30 days to review it if they met the July 9th deadline, but 60 days if they did not. So why is the 60-day period in the interests of the Obama administration?
Well, I think there are two things that are interacting here, and one is the problem that you've just been talking about, that is the arms embargo, and the symbolism for the Iranians is one thing. It's a totally different symbolism, of course, for the Obama administration. That is to symbolize to our old allies, the Saudis, that we are really not just on side, but that we are very actively and aggressively pursuing our role as an ally of the Saudis. And so they were extremely, the Obama administration officials were extremely eager, particularly in the White House, to make sure that the news media were going to be covering this as a hardline position that the Obama administration was taking on the issue of the arms embargo. And, of course, it was accompanied by tough statements, I would say even bellicose statements by the Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey.
Dempsey, yeah. He's the outgoing chairman.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, the outgoing chairman. But the point here is that they wanted to impress the Saudis with their being such a good ally. And so that was part of the reason that they hardened up the line. But the other part of this was that the administration wanted to scotch this argument, which had been given such huge play in the news media, again, following the Israeli line of thinking that Kerry and Obama were much too eager to get an agreement, and therefore they were ready to get an agreement by the time of this deadline, and in so doing they would make more concessions, and that was considered to be an un-American thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So they were at the same time showing that this argument wasn't true, and sort of embellishing their credentials as hardliners in foreign policy.
Gareth, there's much more we could talk about, but you're in demand these days. This is, what, your fourth interview today, and I don't want to wear you out or take up all of your time. But take a moment or two to thumbnail your bottom line assessment here. Is this a reasonable arrangement that delays so-called breakout time, the period that it would take Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, for a 15-year period? And when we strip away all the fiction and the posturing, is this something that you think can hold and that could become the basis for some kind of a new stability in a very unstable region? Unstable because of our actions.
There are huge questions there. On the first question, is this a reasonable settlement? The problem that I have with that is that the whole premise of the negotiations from the point of view of the United States and its allies was, of course, that we had to do this in order to prevent the headlong rush by Iran into nuclear weapons. And that, of course, is totally false. So it's difficult, to have an objective, to make an objective assessment
mm-hmm.
of this settlement in light of the fact that the whole premise of it was such BS.
Yeah.
But the second question, which we are going to have to deal with from now on, is does this agreement portend any shift or any improvement in the relationship between the United States and Iran, and will it have any impact on the chaos that now is engulfing the region? And, I have to tell you that when I was in Vienna covering the talks, the Iranian news media, the Iranian journalists who interviewed me, were so eager to get an assessment of whether there was hope for improvement in relations with the United States and whether this would help to establish a new era. Now, this, of course, is Zarif, the foreign minister of mm-hmm. Iran, Mohammad Javad Zarif's very explicit aim, and he talks about this frequently now. But I'm afraid that I'm very much more pessimistic about this than I think Zarif might be, or might have been at least in the past, because of the political structure, the structural limitations that exist and that have existed for so long in American politics. It's very difficult to see how this administration, much less any future administration, escapes from the hammerlock that the special interests, specifically the Israeli lobby and and the bureaucratic interests in continuing the status quo of such close political military relations with the Saudis as well as the Israelis, that's going to keep the United States from really being able to adjust its policy and to deal with the realities in the Middle East. So I'm sorry to say that I'm fairly pessimistic about that.
Gareth Porter, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your work and highly recommend your book, Manufactured Crisis. And we will talk again soon.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this special in-depth interview with Gareth Porter. I always welcome your comments and feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.